pull up a chair. I want to start today not in the air, but on the ground, in the cold, on a strip of sand where the wind never quits. 1903. December, a place called Kill Devil Hills, a few miles down the beach from a little life-saving station named Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. The temperature is near freezing. There's a wind coming off the Atlantic at better than 20 knots, and the sand is blowing sideways into everything, into your eyes, into the sandwiches. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Taildragger, and this is The Hangar, and today we're going all the way back to the beginning, not the polished version you got in grade school, the real one, with cold hands and a coin toss and a photograph that almost nobody thought to take. Before I get rolling, let me tell you who keeps the lights on around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story, and believe me, the story I'm about to tell you started with two fellows who earned every bit of what they got. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, let me set the scene properly. Wilbur and Orville Wright were not scientists. They were not rich. They ran a bicycle shop in Dayton, Ohio, the Wright Cycle Company. They sold bikes. They fixed bikes. They built a few of their own. And in the back of that shop, with the smell of chain oil and rubber and machine grease, two brothers with no college degrees between them decided they were going to solve a problem that had killed better-funded, better-known men, the problem of powered flight. Now here's where it gets interesting. Everybody at the time was chasing power. They figured if you just bolted a big enough engine to enough wing, you'd bully your way into the sky. The famous men, the government-funded men, that's the road they took. Samuel Langley, backed by the War Department and the Smithsonian, had real money and a real reputation. The Wrights looked at it differently. They were bicycle men. And a bicycle, when you think about it, is an unstable machine that a human being controls through constant tiny corrections. You don't sit on a bicycle and hope. You balance it, you steer it. You're always every second flying that thing down the road. So they asked the question nobody else was really asking. Not how do we get enough power, but how do we control the machine once it's up there? That's the whole ballgame, folks. That's the insight that changed the world. Control, they spent years on it. They built kites. They built gliders. They hauled their contraptions from Ohio down to the Outer Banks of North Carolina because they'd written to the Weather Bureau and found out Kitty Hawk had two things they needed: steady wind and soft sand to crash into. And crash they did over and over, season after season. Wilbur was the older one, intense, bookish, the one who'd stare at a soaring buzzard for an hour and come away with an idea. He watched those birds twist the tips of their wings to bank and turn, and it hit him. The bird isn't rigid. The bird warps its wing. And so the Wrights built wings you could twist with a set of cables, a system they called wing warping. That's your ailerons, in the ancestral form. Roll control, born from watching a buzzard off the North Carolina dunes. But they still didn't have good numbers. The lift tables everybody trusted, the published figures from the respected European experimenters, were wrong, and the Wrights figured that out, the hard way, when their gliders didn't lift like the math promised. So what did two bicycle mechanics do? They built their own wind tunnel. A wooden box about 6 feet long, with a fan driven off the shop's engine, and inside it they tested 200 different little metal wing shapes, tiny airfoils cut from hacksaw blades, measuring lift and drag for themselves. They threw out the textbooks and wrote their own, in the back of a bike shop in Ohio. By the fall of 1903, they had it. The Flyer, wingspan a little over 40 feet, two propellers they'd carved themselves out of laminated spruce, chain-driven, spinning in opposite directions so the twisting forces would cancel out, and an engine. Nobody would sell them a motor that was light enough and strong enough, so their shop mechanic, a fellow named Charlie Taylor, a name that doesn't get said near enough, built one from scratch in 6 weeks, 12 horsepower, aluminum crankcase, which was exotic stuff in those days. No fuel pump, no spark plugs like you'd know them, no throttle to speak of. They shipped the whole thing down to Kill Devil Hills in crates and put it together in a wooden shed, while the wind tried to tear the roof off. First, they had to wait out the weather. Then, on December 14th, they were finally ready. And being fair-minded men, they flipped a coin to see who'd go first. Wilbur won the toss. He climbed on, gave it too much up elevator, stalled it a few feet off the rail, and dug it into the sand. Minor damage, not a real flight, just a stumble. 3 more days of repairs. December 17th, 1903, a Thursday, cold. That wind howling in off the ocean at 20, 25 knots. So cold the five men who'd come over from the life-saving station to help had their hands jammed in their pockets. Now it was Orville's turn. They laid down a 60-foot wooden rail on the sand, a launching track they jokingly called the Junction Railroad. The Flyer sat on a little trolley. Orville lay down flat on the lower wing, on his belly, hips in a padded cradle. To turn, he'd shift his hips and warp the wings. No seat, no windscreen, no instruments except a stopwatch and a little anemometer to catch the numbers, and here's the part I love. Before Orville climbed on, he set up a camera. A big box camera on a tripod, pointed at the end of the rail at about the spot where he figured the machine would lift off, and he asked one of those life-saving men, John Daniels, a great big fellow who had never operated a camera in his entire life, never touched one, to just squeeze the bulb if something worth remembering happened.
Think about that. The most important photograph in the history of human flight was taken by a man who had never used a camera, holding his breath, hoping he did it right. Orville released the wire. The flyer rumbled down the rail into that headwind, Wilbur running alongside, steadying the wingtip. And at the end of the rail, it lifted, it rose, it flew, 12 seconds, about 120 feet, slower than a man can run when you account for that wind. But it was up, and it was under control, and it was powered, and it came down no lower than it started. That's flight. Every box checked for the first time in the history of the world, a human being had left the ground in a powered machine and controlled it through the air and landed no worse for it, and John Daniels, God bless him, squeezed the bulb at the exact right instant. He caught the flyer a couple of feet off the sand. Wilbur frozen mid-stride at the wingtip where he'd just let go. Later Daniels said he was so excited he wasn't even sure he'd done it. They didn't know if they had the shot until the glass plate negative was developed back in Ohio weeks later. That photograph. If you've seen one image from aviation history, you've seen that one. And it very nearly never existed, because it depended on a nervous stranger with cold hands and a camera he didn't understand. They flew three more times that morning, trading off, each flight a little longer. The fourth one, Wilbur at the controls, went 852 feet and stayed up 59 seconds. Now they were really flying. And then, with the machine sitting on the sand between flights, a gust caught it, started tumbling it, end over end across the beach. John Daniels, the same man, grabbed a strut trying to save it and got carried along, rolled up inside the wires and the wood as it flipped, banged him up good. He'd laugh for the rest of his life. That he was the survivor of the world's first airplane accident. The flyer was wrecked, it never flew again, but it didn't need to. It had already done the one thing no machine had ever done. Here's what gets me. Sitting here all these years later, they sent a telegram home to Dayton that afternoon. Told their father they'd flown and to inform the press, and the world mostly shrugged. A few garbled newspaper stories, most of them wrong. It would be years before people really believed. Two bicycle makers from Ohio had cracked it, while the famous funded men had faceplanted into the Potomac, but the pilots knew. The ones who came after knew. Every single one of us who has ever pushed a throttle forward and felt the wheels go light. We are all flying in the wake of 12 seconds over a cold beach in North Carolina. Wing warping became ailerons. That wind tunnel became every wind tunnel. And the idea, the real idea, that a flying machine is a thing you control, that you balance it like a bicycle down an invisible road, that idea is sitting in your hands every time you fly. The original flyer hangs today in the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum in Washington. Go stand under it if you ever get the chance. It's smaller than you'd think and it's braver than you can imagine. My thanks to the National Air and Space Museum and the historical record left behind by the Wright brothers themselves, whose diaries and letters kept the day alive down to the minute. You can find us at RadioHonger.com. So the next time the wind's honking down the runway and you're grumbling about it, remember, those two brothers went looking for that wind. They needed it, and on a freezing Thursday morning, it carried the whole world into the air. This is Taildragger. Keep the dirty side down, and I'll see you next time.